Thanks. Thanks, Dave. I was originally asked a year or more ago to give a kind of short synoptic sort of sketchy introduction to a conference on art and time, and the idea was to give a sort of history of a brief history of conceptions of time, and I didn't feel I could do this without trying to come to grips, even in a very sketchy way, with philosophical and to some extent religious conceptions of time. But the audience at that stage consisted of art historians, literary studies people, film studies people, and the good thing was there were no philosophers there. So this was the country of the blind in which the one-eyed man was king. I could say whatever I wanted and nobody could point out how elementary or basically wrong it was. But the bad thing was that there were no philosophers there. So there was actually nobody to tell me that that I was wasting my time with this project of trying to link in some way on a very broad scale philosophical and artistic conceptions of time. So I'm extremely grateful to Dave and Hugh for giving me a chance to try this out on an extremely two-eyed, far-sighted 2020 vision audience like this one, who can tell me whether it's either A, elementary, or B, wrong. And I shouldn't even be trying to continue with a project like this. So thank you to both of you. I'm looking forward also to hearing what you think of the other bit, because the perspective you'll have on the stuff about, in fact, it's about poetry specifically rather than art, it will be completely different from what I heard last time. When this was even sketchier, you'll be horrified to hear than it is now. So the paper's in two parts. Oh, and by the way, it wasn't going to be a PowerPoint. It isn't a PowerPoint. But I just felt obliged after the last three presentations, all of them, particularly Janan, so fluent technically, I felt I had to have some effort to keep up the game from a literary studies point of view. So I put a few slides up here, but it's actually not a PowerPoint presentation, not really, just some quotations. So anyway, this is in two parts. The first half is an attempt to set out very, very briefly, in a way that I fear some of you may find all too elementary, some version of the history of philosophical and religious conceptions of time interspersed with some more literary commentary and drawing some tentative conclusions about how one might group them. And then the second part of the paper is an equally long-range account of artistic or more accurately poetic representations of time, especially as bearing on the consciousness of the poet or the character in the poem. And then again, I tried to draw some general conclusions at the end about how poetry, as it were, does time and consciousness before tentatively linking these conclusions to the other ones about religion and philosophy. So this is the first part now. Now, most people, as you'd know much better than I, seem to begin with Augustine when reviewing the history of conceptions of time, usually noting, one, that it seems impossible to say what the concept means, even though we all know how to use it. And there's the famous sentence from Augustine at the top of the slide there, si nemo ex me quaeret scio, si quaerenti explicare velim nescio, a typically Augustinian turn of phrase where usually the second phrase negates the first one and then usually there's a third one negating the second. But here, if nobody asks me, I know. If I wish to explain to somebody asking me, I do not know, which actually seems, as so often in the confessions, to be about willing and wishing as much as about anything else. It's when I wish to explain that I don't know what it is. The wish to explicate evaporates the knowledge that seems to have been present before. And the second Augustinian crux, the famous one, that time appears to us as a passing flow, such that only the punctual present can be thought of as real, the past having ceased to be so, and the future not being so yet. A worry about the reality of time, which is, in Augustine's case, of course, as much a religious as a philosophical worry, deriving from Plotinus as much as from Aristotle, about our consciousness and measurement of time. Sentimus intervalla temporum, I feel the intervals of time, of times. In you, in te anima meus, tempora mea meteor, affectionem, quam res praeteriuntes in te faciunt, ipsam meteor praesentem. In you, my mind, or my soul, my spirit, in you I measure my times, in you. Impression, the present consciousness, affectionem, it sounds like affection, but the impression which passing things make in you, that is my soul again, I measure this as the present itself. All in Book 11 of the Confessions, written at the end of the 4th century AD, but still seeming very modern when you read it today. Augustine even comments elsewhere that there's nothing we talk about more than time, no word that appears in our vocabulary more often than that does, which I think was exactly what a recent survey of the most used words in the English language found. Isn't that right? Did anybody else see that? Time is the word that comes up most often in ordinary speech, everyday speech. But I'm not going to begin with Augustine. I'm going to begin with Hugh Price, whose own book I found extremely helpful in cribbing this account of what philosophers think about time for my conference last year. And Hugh's book, appealingly, begins not with Augustine, but with Groucho Marx. You know, time flies like an arrow, fruit flies like a banana. And as I understand the explanation in the book, Hugh espouses what the philosophers and physicists refer to as the block view or block universe view of time, that is, of time as seen from some Archimedean point outside the world, where the opposing or contrary view, and I'm still paraphrasing, is of time's arrow, that is, of time as a river or flow, not always straight like an arrow's flight. Not that arrows, of course, fly straight, but often circular or cyclical or meandering or maybe even curved or boomerang-shaped or, dare I say it, banana-shaped. But in any case, moving in a single, consistent, irreversible sense, perhaps rather than direction. Another philosopher to have taken the block view of time in recent years is Jack Smart, who explains the other view, the flow view, the opposing view, as it's come down from Augustine, like this. Events approach us from the future, are momentarily caught in the spotlight of the present, and then recede into the past. Only in the infinitesimal present is the moment real. And it's hard in listening to Smart explaining this view not to recall Augustine, or for a literary person, not to recall the famous pact made by Faust with Mephistopheles in Goethe's version of the Faust story, which is the third quotation on the screen. Wer dich zum Augenblick sagen, wer weile doch, du bist so schön. If I could just say to the passing moment, stay now, thou art, you are so beautiful. A plea to the perfect moment to remain, to stay, which Faust wagers with Mephistopheles that he will never utter, because to do so would be to reject the Faustian notion of life or of consciousness, to reject the notion of the modern identity as a stream of never satisfied experience. Though, of course, at the same time, Faust rather wishes that he loses the bet and he could find such a moment, but then, of course, that would be to lose the bet. On this modified Augustinian account, the passage or flow of time is still itself an objective feature of reality, regardless of how we resolve the ontological problem of the unreality of past and future. The dimensionless point of the present is what Smart calls the marker or leading edge of the flow, the point of contact between the moving finger and the page, the ink already drying as the finger, having writ, moves on. And of course, the text is always lengthening, always constantly unscrolling itself as the unwritten future progressively becomes the written past. But on the block view of time, any kind of flow is illusory. Reality is a single entity, if I've understood this, with no ontological division into past, present, and future. Now just means this moment when I, the speaker, speak, as here means this place where I stand. The block exists in three spatial dimensions and one temporal one, and it is how the world actually is, rather than how it appears to be to beings in time. This, says Hugh Price, is the Archimedean view from nowhen, adapting Thomas Nagel's ethical concept of the impersonal view from nowhere, which Nagel's view allows us to stand outside and thus adjudicate between incommensurable value systems. But whereas Nagel's view from nowhere can only be an ethical device, because of course there isn't ever, can't be a real ethical nowhere, the view from nowhen gets us right outside the illusion of time's flow to actual reality, according to its proponents. So Price's project thus takes its place in the long evolution of the non-anthropocentric view of the universe in the tradition of Copernicus, Galileo, Newton, and Einstein. But then, as we know, some phenomena seem resistant to the Bloch view. The second law of thermodynamics says that entropy, intriguingly, means an inward turn, in view of some of the things that we were hearing just before, an inward turn. Entropy increases over time. Order is erased, or things, as Yeats said in 1919, things fall apart. As the universe ages, matter becomes more unevenly distributed. The galaxies are quite literally falling apart. This seems to be a genuine asymmetry. Time appears to have an irreversible direction. I'm talking here about things I know very little about, so I'm conscious of being a little vulnerable here. There's an entropy gradient, and we, the universe, appear to be moving down it. Isn't this the sharpest of all time's arrows? And isn't it also reflected at the micro level in the fact that we have no memory of the future, or rather, as Smart says, no analogous trace of the future corresponding to memory as a trace of the past? Well, maybe not. First of all, as Price observes, and again I'm offering a fairly simple-minded paraphrase, all we can really say is that there is an entropy gradient, but it isn't necessary to see the universe as moving along it in one direction rather than another. Why not say that entropy decreases towards the past rather than that it increases towards the future? Why does time's flow have to be thought of as having an objective direction? We don't ask how fast does time flow, because presumably it flows at 1 second per second, so why ask which way does it flow? The laws of quantum mechanics, of dynamics, of electromagnetics are time symmetrical. It's physically possible for any event falling under those laws to happen in reverse. Things in time, in short, may be asymmetrical or perspectival, but that doesn't mean the whole system is. And besides, the entropy gradient in some other state of the universe could just as easily be the other way round, so that the universe was getting more ordered, in which case time there would seem to run in the opposite direction. Also, subsystems within the universe may have lower entropy for a while, so long as other subsystems have compensating higher entropy. And this gets very interesting for a non-philosophical literary person. That is, increasing local order is common. Jack Smart's examples of increasing order, branch systems displaying negative entropy, his examples include footprints in the sand, fossil bones, and coherent pieces of prose. And I'd add to that that poetry is typically even more ordered than prose. So, a conclusion one is tempted to draw is that if you really dare to disturb the universe, as Prufrock in Eliot's poem did not do, but of course Eliot himself did, if you dare to disturb the universe, you should write a poem. You should be human. You should have a history. The growth of civilization on the Bloch view of time is negatively entropic. It defeats time or causes us to reimagine time. Or the positive entropy of the whole system is exactly what makes the negative entropy of some subsystems possible. If the universe were not expanding, we couldn't have poetry or art or civilization at all. Well, you might think this is a bit far-fetched, but what this suggests for me is that this Bloch view of time is certainly worth dwelling on from the point of view of someone interested in the arts, in the literary arts, and the flow view worth escaping, at least for a while. Still, as Price says, our prejudices, our established models of consciousness, aren't easy to extract ourselves from. We still act and talk as if the sun rises, even though we've known for centuries that it doesn't. And so it seems that living with two views of time is what we, a Western we, have always done. The Ionians, Heraclitus, Thales, Democritus, first articulated the flow or river view of the cosmos as everlasting change or becoming in the 6th century BC. Of course, there notably one thing that doesn't change is the law of change itself. And the Eleatic school, Parmenides and Zeno, developed the Bloch view of the cosmos as being in the next century. Zeno's paradox is being a version of the Bloch view of time, When time is thought of as infinitely divisible into infinitesimal moments, the flying arrow can never be thought of as reaching its target because it's only ever in a moment and never moves between moments. And by the way, the block view need, I take it, be neither static nor determinist, despite these implications of that spatial term block. Dynamic movement in time exists as part of the block. Saying that we can't change the future doesn't mean that we have no choices, only that the future is what we choose, which, if anything, is more existentialist than determinist. Next step, Plato's dualistic universe contains the cognizable being of the forms existing in aeon or eternity on the one hand, and the evanescent, time-bound or chronos-bound world of everlasting sensory becoming on the other hand. This unites the two earlier models, as well as introducing into Western thought a version of the old Indian prejudice against the world of becoming, which is itself a cyclical rather than a straight arrow version of the flow model. Plato's conception of the 36,000-year great year gave rise to various extreme later views, as in some Stoics, such as Marcus Aurelius, who believed fatalistically in an exact repetition of history. Even Aristotle, who was interested mainly in time as kinesis, as measurable motion or change or process, even he accepted the Platonic aeon chronos view of time as cyclical and ephemeral on one level and eternal and unchanging on another. One might even think, incidentally, of, and this has been in the background once or twice already today, of those two other great forms of art, music on the one hand and painting, sculpture, the plastic arts on the other, as corresponding to these two views of time, music to the flow and painting, sculpture, etc. to the block. Another radical change in Western conceptions of time came with the uniting of the dualistic Platonic view in its turn with the Judeo-Christian model, which had no analogue in other ancient systems of thought, whether Indian, Chinese, African or South American. The God of the Jews, Jehovah, is remarkable above all for his active and provident, provident or foreseeing interventions in the world of time. His providence is actually more salient for a relatively non-speculative religion such as Judaism than his eternity is, where the Neoplatonism of Augustine is the other way round. Non-eternal time is for Judaism more dynamic than kinetic. It always has a foreseen or providential goal towards which, or in terms of which, its motion or change is thought of, rather than just being motion or change relative to the absence of motion or change. Meanwhile, Christianity, for its part, not only included strongly Platonist and Neoplatonist strands of thought, in which the nature of an eternal God as an unmoved mover outside time is highly salient and interesting because time is an image or reflection of eternity and humanity is an image of God, but also Christianity made the intervention of the eternal and providential in human history, that is in the form of the incarnation, the very heart of the religion. Jesus was historically real, lived at a certain temporal and spatial point in the past, and will as certainly return in the future. His life, a terminus both antequem and postquem, fulfilled one dispensation even as it initiated another one. Here the focus of historical interest shifts from the meaning of the past, the fall, the flood, the mosaic events, to the meaning of the present and the future, what happens between the incarnation and the second coming. And of course, on the Judeo-Christian model, history itself is completely changed. No longer is it a continuous sequence of homogeneous events, one damned thing after another, so to speak. Now it contains unique events, ruptures, and it has a direction, a purpose. Time is now not chronos, but a new word, kairos, K-A-I-R-O-S. That is not measurable abstract time, but what the translators call seasonableness, timeliness, the fullness of time. The Liddell and Scott, the standard Greek dictionary, offer due measure, proportion, fitness, or season That's the translation of kairos. The word is closely related to kainos, which means new or novel, and to kinesis, which means movement. So the sense of kairos is not so much time as in it's 5 o'clock, but as in it's time he shut up and let us go and have some tea. A different sense of time. Hereafter, the major thinkers of the West, such as Augustine, Boethius, and Aquinas, from late classical times into the medieval era, despite retaining the block flow, eternity time contrast as the very centre of their thought and of the world as they saw it, nevertheless saw the flow as directional and also as informed by or directed towards the block in a way that it wasn't for the Greeks. The river now runs to the sea, it's not just a river. In Aquinas' definitive image, God is a watcher on the summit of eternity, looking down in a single, simple glance on the whole course of time. The implication here being that we can aspire to that same perspective and should always try to achieve it, although being merely human, we never will. Then the pre-Renaissance and the early Renaissance recovered more Greek thought, meaning especially more Aristotle, and then, above all, in the case of Aquinas, held the Greek and Christian views in tension together. But as the later Renaissance overlapped with the rise of the new science and the new philosophy, one anti-anthropocentric and the other extremely inward, the recourse to eternity that had been shared by Greek and Christian systems alike was gradually leached away, leaving only the frightening secular sense of the fleetingness of individual time, whether cyclical or arrow-like, and the urgent need to cling on to it as it passes, as most famously in the case of Montaigne, in his reflection, as he says, this is Flouriot's translation, "We must tooth and nail retain the use of this life's pleasures, which our years snatch from us." And the same sense in that poem whose very title emphasizes this point, Paradise Lost. Now, a third era in Western philosophical conceptions of time was already beginning as Milton wrote his epic, the one which by and large, the era which by and large we're still in. As far as conceptions of time are concerned, as with conceptions of the self, the key figure here is probably Locke rather than Descartes. Locke's crucial step, while arguably just imparting an extra spin to the Cartesian inward turn, I don't know if this is a cricketing metaphor or a return to the meaning of the word entropy, was to replace a metaphysical conception of time with an epistemological one. Locke says firmly in Book 2 of the essay in the chapter on duration, taking his lead from Augustine, "Time is itself not to be discovered. What we can know is an idea of succession and of duration." And as he says, "Reflection on these appearances of several ideas one after another in our minds is that which furnishes us with the idea of succession. And the distance between any parts of that succession or between the appearance of any two ideas in our minds is that we call duration." As Locke bridges the gap between Augustine and Aristotle, time is the measurement of duration. And indeed, it was Locke who prepared the way for, and in many ways actually anticipated, the Kantian revolution. Famously, in the Transcendental Aesthetic, time is variously described as a necessary representation that grounds all intuitions, a pure form of sensible intuition, the form of inner sense, the a priori formal condition of all appearances in general, merely a subjective condition of our human intuition, and in itself, outside the subject, nothing. Time is real because it is part of every experience, not because it is in the experience world of objects, nor because the objects are in it, but because it is a basic feature of our experience, a necessary condition for our having experience at all, a configuration of experiencing, an aspect of consciousness. Even in Locke, ideas still seem at least to appear in a string, in a row, having some resemblance to the old flow model. But in Kant, it seems there is no flow and no block. The period of the critiques was also that of the advent of modern geology and zoology. Kant himself was perhaps the last great thinker to explore time both as a scientist and as a philosopher, fully in both camps. 25 years before the first critique, he published his Universal Natural History and Theory of the Heavens, in which nature is portrayed as always in a state of becoming, rather than forever as it was created, inaugurating the era of Linnaeus, Buffon, Cuvier, Lamarck, and eventually Lyell and Darwin. The dynamic natura naturans of Romanticism was replacing the static natura naturata of the Renaissance. And from here on, which is to say from Kant onwards, the main argument about time appears not so much to be between flowers and blockers, though both still do exist, as between subjectivists and objectivists. The latter, objectivists principally being scientists, positivists, mechanists, historicists, and broadly materialist philosophers who see time as a real feature of the world, subjectivists being mainly phenomenologists and psychologists who see it principally as a feature of consciousness. And this is a group that includes thinkers otherwise as unlike each other as William James, who relaunched the Lockean project of finding a sensory basis for our conceptions of time in Principles of Psychology in 1908, and Bergson, who saw time as not just the form of inner sense, as in Kant, but as its very matter. If you strip away, or as Husserl would say, Husserl and Bergson being born in 1859, same age, if you bracket all the phenomena of consciousness, what you're left with is what Bergson calls durée, duration. This kind of time as the very extension of experience, is seen as open-ended, real in the memory, but creative of the future. On this model, which is chiric, not chronic, time is all but indistinguishable from the very self, the moi profond, as Bergson calls it, or what Heidegger refers to as the eigentlich, or authentic self. Although I have to say I don't understand either Heidegger or Bergson very well, and I may need some help here. But below the level of ordinary consciousness and even of reflective and conceptual thought, present as an awareness of its own continuing and self-creating existence. And this model was, of course, given unforgettable expression in the work of Bergson's young cousin, of whom we've already heard from Janan, Marcel Proust. It may seem as if identifying consciousness and time in this way moves us finally beyond the block-flow dichotomy. But in fact, Bergson's own often repeated insistence that durée is non-spatial and should not be conceived of as if it were spatial often seems vitiated, contradicted by his own use of metaphors of depth and flow, which is constant, and looks instead rather like an attempt to fuse the models of the flow and the block. Nietzsche had attempted something similar a generation earlier in his conception of eternal recurrence. Imagine yourself as having to live every single moment of experience over and over again for all eternity. See the flow as a block, and then see the universe as an endless series of identical blocks. Heidegger saw the condition of being in time, of temporality or indeed of mortality, not so much as the immediate fabric of experience or of self-creation, but as something more like its goal, that towards which, or in full awareness of which, the self will finally understand and free itself. Bergson's contemporary, just to finish this part on philosophical conceptions of time, the British Hegelian J.M.E. MacTaggart, thought that although time itself is unreal, we do seem to have two ways of talking about it, corresponding to two views of time itself. On the one hand, we talk of things being past, present, and future. Today or tomorrow, we might truthfully say, the conference on time and consciousness at the Centre for Time is happening now, in the present. At any other time in all of the past and the future, this would not be true. The conference will happen in the future, was true for billions of years, but will never be true again. The conference happened in the past, has never been true before, but on Monday it will be, and will then remain true until the end of time. This is the tense language that MacTaggart, of course, called the A series, representing time as a kind of Augustinian moving now. On the other hand, if you say the Centre's conference on time and consciousness is later than the one on causal thinking, then that has always been true and always will be, with the word is expressing a tenseless truth. and this is what McTaggart, as I understand it, calls the B series, representing time as static and permanent. And these time language arguments, as you know much better than I, initiated 20th century considerations of time in the analytical tradition by Russell, Moore, Broad, Dummett and others, as opposed to consideration in the subjective mode, either of a continental phenomenological kind or of the Jamesian psychological kind. But McTaggart's A and B series do bear a strong resemblance, I think, to the ancient tradition of flow and block thinking, which predated the post-Kantian subjectivist strain. So in terms of the history of philosophy then, even though we're now in a third Lockean-Kantian age of subjectivist thinking about time, with linguistic and objectivist strands running alongside, all the views, except possibly Kant's own, tend to resolve back and divide into flow and block variants. That is, despite Bergson's warnings, they tend to spatialise time in one or other, I'd suggest, of those two ways. So now the question is, does art do the same thing, or does it do something else entirely? And I'm not going to talk about art, I'm going to talk about poetry, and only three or four examples of that. So art sounds like a rather grand term for what I'm doing here. Paul Ricoeur argues that narrative, unlike philosophy or science, is able to avoid thinking about time disjunctively as either cosmic or psychic, as either objective or subjective, and he's talking about narrative specifically. But could we see the arts in general as forms of thought in which time is represented as neither block nor flow? Does poetry, for example, avoid thinking about time at all, as opposed to thinking in time or with time, or just showing this thinking? Might this be just the kind of time-life thinking that philosophers like Bergson advocate, even though it seems, qua philosophers, they can never do it themselves? And here are some famous examples from poets I've chosen specifically because of their canonical stature. In fact, they're not so much canonized as apotheosized, chosen for the very reason that their reputations seem to transcend time, and also because collectively they cover the same large-scale time span as the philosophers that I've just that I've been all too quickly flicking through. First of all, two examples from the Iliad. I told you it was a long timescale. So we're starting at the beginning. In book 18 of the poem, we are shown the marvellous, divinely crafted shield of the leading Greek hero, Achilles. And on the shield, the entire cosmos, along with representative scenes from human life, are depicted literally from a god's eye view, a view from nowhere and no when. And the effect of this passage, the description of the shield of Achilles, which you probably will remember, is to lift us out of the welter of killing and squabbling in which we are inescapably immersed for the whole of the rest of the poem, so that for a moment, which is the moment of art, we see and celebrate life from that Archimedean point. The poetry itself, even, if you look at the passage, the poetry becomes denser and richer, standing out itself, as it were, in relief from the flat, relatively flat surface of the surrounding text, as it both describes and enacts the figurative relief work on the shield. This sudden and, within the poem, quite unique perspective gives us to understand that occasionally being able to see and always to remember seeing life like this is necessary if we are going to bear being in it the rest of the time. And on another level, you might say the entire poem has just this kind of value. And then in book 24, a little bit later, there's another scene in which the old Trojan king, Priam, comes to beg the terrible Achilles for the body of Priam's son, Hector. And Achilles, the slayer of men, ruefully sees himself for what he is, for what he really is, for the first time. That is, as his father's... Oh, it slipped off the PowerPoint. No, there it is. Henna Paida Panaorion, third up. Which means, literally, one child, all not of the hour. One child, all not of the hour, Panaorion. All not of the hour is variously translated by classicists as meaning either doomed to an untimely death, or, and this is more as the consensus amongst the translators, doomed to live an untimely or unseasonable life. In other words, by implication, Achilles' egregious life, standing out from the other lives in the text, like his shield stands out from the other objects in the poem, his egregious life is contrasted with the gregarious norm, as in the cases of Hector or Priam. But the standard for them all, the rule which the exceptional Achilles is supposed to prove, is quasi-chiric, kairos. This is just as true in the apparently more driven or directed second poem by Homer, the Odyssey, whose long-suffering hero is in fact returning home, completing a 20-year cycle. And I say quasi-chiric because what matters to Homer is the timeliness or the seasonableness or the meaningfulness of lives in themselves, rather than in their significance as parts of some larger pattern that they belong in. It isn't quite the Judaic kind of chiric time, but it's still chiric, I think, in a way. It's not the fullness of time that's the point in Homer, it's the fullness of a life, of time, time in a life. Now, so much very briefly for Homer. Is the same thing true of that belated Odyssey, the third great epic of the ancient world, the Aeneid? Aeneas's whole life is directed towards that future, still unrealized Rome, which Virgil is always celebrating and mythologizing. Aeneas's is a life centered on the concept Rome. And only in terms of that concept and what Rome means does everything else in the poem make sense. The central defining concept of Aeneas's own character is pietas, worth comparing with its nearest Homeric equivalent, which is eidos. Pietas means, roughly translated, piety, but that's not a very good translation. Eidos means something like, take them in turn. Pietas is something like a categorical imperative. God-fearingness, in fact God-drivenness, made into an overriding, forward-looking, or arrow-like inner sense of duty and mission. Whereas eidos, usually translated as shame, but meaning something more like the capacity to feel shame or esteem, a kind of openness to the repute in which others hold you. Eidos is seen notably in Hector, who in Homer's poem is Aeneas's cousin and is clearly the figure in the Iliad on whom, more than any other, Virgil was to base his character of Aeneas. Eidos is a disposition to recognise one's proper place in the human world and its proper place in the cosmos. It's part of that Homeric kind of chiric time. Homer's eidos helps us to be in the circle, or the block, of life. Virgil's pietas helps us break out of it, to make out of life not a circle, but a mission. And in fact, it's Dido, if you remember the story of Dido and Aeneas, her pudor, or her modesty, itself a kind of eidos. It's Dido who wants to keep Aeneas in her city and who plays the Homeric role in Virgil's poem. But Aeneas, who's a straight arrow kind of guy, if ever there was one, is controlled by a destiny which operates like a kind of divine microchip. Even Achilles, exceptional and somewhat robotic semi-divinity that he is still not quite like this, not quite as frightening, it seems to me, as Aeneas. Driven forward in time as well as space, just as the entire epic is driven by its conception of all human history as culminating in Augustan Rome. Now, this poem, unlike Homer's, is quite easily mapped onto our philosophical models. Virgil isn't so very unlike Augustine or the Bible, where Homer incorporates and dissolves Parmenides and Heraclitus. Time in the Aeneid is fully chiric. Aeneas's life, unlike Dido's, unlike Achilles's, Aeneas's life is hardly his own, can't be called his own, always seen against the perspective of the long view of time, the long flow, the arrow. My third case, and you'll notice I'm sticking only to the really big names, my third case is Dante. And between Virgil and Dante intervened the whole of Augustinian and Pauline Christianity, adding its own historically unique sense of directedness, albeit moderated by Aristotle and Aquinas, to that of Virgil, who is, of course, actually embodied in the poem as Dante's guide. He appears, you'll recall, leading Dante through the Inferno, although he fades out by the time they get to Purgatory. There's room this time only for one famous example, and I've chosen this one because it's the appearance of a Homeric hero, Odysseus, who turns up in the eighth circle of hell in the Inferno as the Dantean character Ulysses. And what he's doing in the Inferno is he's being punished for betrayal and false counsel. And poor old Odysseus didn't have a chance in this poem because he was not just a Greek, but the Greek most responsible for the fall of Troy. And therefore he was despicable to Aeneas, who's a Trojan, to Virgil, who's a Roman, arguing that Rome was descended from Troy, that Rome is Trojan, and also Dante, who was an Italian, descended from Rome. So what hope for Odysseus? The terms in which the damned Ulysses describes his voyages to Dante, the last quotation on the slide, are humanist terms. Considerate la vostra semenza, fatti non foste a viver come bruti, ma per seguir virtute e conoscenza. Think of your inheritance, think of your seed. We were not made to live as brutes, but to follow virtue and knowledge. But celebrated as these terms, virtue and knowledge, have become, they are implicitly being rejected in the context of the comedy of the Inferno by Dante the pilgrim and Dante the poet, because his own voyage to paradise is offered by the poem as exemplary, just the kind of voyage that poor old Ulysses failed to achieve. The key term of Dante's voyage, the right kind, is not virtue, not virtute, but amor. Amor, love, is Dante's pietas, Dante's equivalent of that Virgilian driving force in Aeneas. The driving force that not only rules Dante, but, according to the last line of the whole poem, that moves the sun and the other stars. Love takes Dante from Beatrice to God, to true knowledge, whereas Ulysses' virtute takes him to false knowledge, to death at sea, and then, of course, to damnation. And what happens in the comedy is that it places the Homeric virtues, such as eidos, arete, and time, honour, in a Christian context, so that the lives they inform are made to look narrowly circumscribed and directionless. As in Virgil and the Bible, the relationship in Dante between time and lives is evaluated on an historico-cosmic and chiric scale, not on an individual one. Fourth case, this is Shakespeare, and I'm referring first to the sonnets, which are dominated by time as they are by no other concept, and which are dominated by time as no other body of poems in English really is. I've just put a few quotations fairly randomly selected from the sonnets on the screen. Nothing gainst time's scythe can make defence, save breed to brave him when he takes thee hence. All you can do about time is have children. Make war upon this bloody tyrant time, in sonnet 16. Do thy worst, old time, my love shall in my verse live ever young, 19. Like as the waves make towards the pebbled shore, so do our minutes hasten to their end. Time will come and take my love away. Shall time's best jewel from time's chest lie hid? Give my love fame faster than time wastes life, so thou prevent'st his scythe and crooked knife. No, time, thou shalt not boast that I do change. Have I got this one on the screen? Yes. O thou, my lovely boy, who in thy power dost hold time's fickle glass, his fickle hour. In all these places, and many more, a uniquely personalised time is our great enemy. There is no impersonal, historico-divine scale of reference to bring him down to size, so to speak, so he appears as a giant, almost as death itself, with nothing but oblivion in his train. And yet, from their hopeless struggle with this invincible figure, the lives of the sonnets are represented as deriving their shape, their energy, their productivity. I suppose this is the kind of thing Heidegger had in mind in seeing time as the spur to being, or death as the spur to being. But the impulse here, it seems to me, is more like a Homeric one, struggling with the intervening Virgilian and Christian models, so that the figure of time appears in Shakespeare as a kind of titanic survivor of those messianic worldviews against which human beings must test themselves. And just to turn briefly to a play, Troilus and Cressida, which is Shakespeare's actual revision, his attempt to rewrite the Iliad, and a highly sceptical and disillusioned version it is too. In Troilus and Cressida, time is referred to more often and more centrally than in any other of the plays. And time is that old common arbitrator, that great-sized monster of ingratitude, the most implacable of all the warriors at Troy, a two-faced, fashionable host, warmly greeting the arrivals and coldly ignoring the departures. Have you ever done that at one of your parties? A robber who scants us with a single famished kiss. Beauty, wit, high birth, vigour of bone, desert in service, love, friendship, charity are subject all to envious and calumniating time. And again, I haven't put this on the screen, but it's the same sort of time as in the sonnets, a highly personalised figure pitted against human beings. You'll remember Macbeth's reiterative temporal inferno, where countless tomorrows creep on to the last syllable of recorded time, while countless yesterdays have no meaning but as a pathway to the death of fools. Merely a very much darker version of this same conception of time, sounding like an earlier version of the Nietzschean nightmare. But generally, in Shakespeare, in Troilus and Cressida particularly, the tone is not so often of existentialist gloom as of unsentimental proactiveness or courage. Time in Shakespeare is the mainspring of individual lives. It both drives them on and it runs them down in the same breath, in the same motion. The question is what it drives them to, what it drives them to become, what each of us makes of this fully recognised subjection, rounded with a sleep, as each of us knows it must be. Now, my last two examples, in case you're wondering whether I'm ever going to stop. Are from the modern era. And Janan will recognise this one, and a lot of you will straight away, but I've got two quotations. Here's the first one. For me, these two ways, the Méséglise way and the Guermantes way, remain linked to a great many small events in the particular mode of life which, of all the different parallel lives, deep, vertically deep, led by each of us, is the richest in happenings, the fullest in untoward incident, namely, the life of the mind. The Méséglise way and the Guermantes way, you know, you remember there were two paths that the child used to take with his family, I can only think of as deep strata in my mental geology, as the solid ground on which my foundations still stand. It was because I had an implicit belief in people and things, as I explored these two ways, that the things and people they brought to my attention are the only ones I can now take seriously and in which I can find any joy. I'm just going to keep going. There are in our existence spots of time that with distinct preeminence retain a renovating virtue whence our minds are nourished and invisibly repaired. This efficacious spirit chiefly lurks among those passages of life that give profoundest knowledge to what point and how the mind is lord and master. Higher minds need not extraordinary calls to rouse them. In a world of life they live, and hold fit converse with the spiritual world and with the generations of mankind spread over time, past, present, and to come, age after age, till time shall be no more. It's curious to me how these two passages sound so alike that they might almost run on from each other and be a single passage. But in fact, the second one is from Wordsworth, from Tintern Abbey. I just converted it into prose, so it looked like the form of the first one, which is, of course, from Swan's Way. And you might call Wordsworth's passage, this one here, the Tintern Way, just as the Proust passage is about the Méséglise and Guermantes ways, one written in 1790-something, the other early in the 20th century, so it's a long gap in time, but very alike. Wordsworth says that he owes to this Tintern way a purer mind, a purification of his mind. He owes that tranquil restoration and deep power of joy which enable him to see into the life of things. Wordsworth and Proust alike, and in almost identical terms, writing in the third or inward era of thinking about time, offer a romantic and aesthetic solution, a post-Kantian solution, to the problem of time and consciousness posed by the Renaissance and by the subsequent ebbing of faith. They both say that romantic joy derives from the individual's recollection or recollection of meaning-laden moments from the flow of time, moments of such intensity that they overcome our anxious sense of the flow, so that time seems to be no more. It's almost as if flow becomes block, as if they're telling us, as I think Price and others are telling us, to take the block view seriously at the level of time consciousness or self-awareness. To invoke a third modern poet in Four Quartets, this is Eliot, history should be seen as a pattern of timeless moments, which, when we recollect them, redeems us from time, from the eternal present of hollow men like Macbeth. Eliot seems to have integrated Thomist Christian and Bergsonian romantic conceptions of time in such phrases as, only through time, time is conquered. To be conscious is not to be in time. He also says elsewhere that mankind cannot bear very much reality. It seems that few poets since Shakespeare could bear Shakespeare's conception of time as an invincible giant foe, who nevertheless calls the best out of us in the lifelong struggle with him that we always must lose and are conscious that we always must lose. So the modern poet, unable to be this strong, tries to conquer time by altering our consciousness of it, if possible accepting or working with the Kantian move outside block and flow, but if pushed, preferring the block view to the flow. So, maybe as Ricoeur says, poetry does avoid thinking disjunctively about time as either block or flow, and even, as Bergson recommends, avoids thinking about it spatially at all, though it still, of course, thinks metaphorically, as indeed does philosophy. To think spatially about time is a metaphorical thing to do. Philosophy, it seems, has nearly always tried to make sense of this concept using these spatial metaphors, while poetry only sometimes does this and more often uses other metaphors. This may be because philosophy is a way of thought typically characterized by trying to make sense of concepts, while poetry is a way of thought typically characterized by trying to make sense of lives. But what's important is that poetry's time thinking is almost indistinguishable from its life thinking, its thought about the self. If you look at what we might call big time poets, like Virgil and Dante, in whom the relationship between time and individual lives is seen on a grand timescale, you find that they also offer a certain model of the self as a solitary point preoccupied or driven by central passion concepts such as amor or pietas. The solitary point or punctual centre is like a time chip driving these somewhat robotic selves. This isn't true of Homer or Shakespeare, who I would say are small-time poets. If you've never thought of Shakespeare as a small-time poet, and you heard it here for the first time. They're small-time poets in the sense that in their thought, the self is more diversified, more intersubjective with other selves, more pitted against a giant foe, but nevertheless courageously defining itself against that consciousness. Big-timers are flow people. Small-timers aren't really either block or flow. Romantic and post-romantic, or post-Kantian poets, for their part, were both the inheritors and the disseminators of precisely that Cartesian, Rousseauvian, and Kantian conception of the moi profond, the deepest, innermost, truest self, which appears in Bergson as the key to time, or rather time appears as the key to it. That concept of a deep self, I'm nearly finished, which is in Freud too, everywhere, obviously, carries with it a powerful drive to isolate the self, to find all of life's meaning within it, to make its private search for life's meaning or shape all that there is to its life. And I think this is a kind of internalized or privatized version of the Virgilian or Dantean big time search, but this time a block version, conducted in the cases I've mentioned in terms of the timeless moments which overcome time or the fearful consciousness of time. So in this third age of our negatively entropic civilization, time in art seems to have become principally an agent of self-preservation. Art seems to have turned somewhat towards the block view of time, it's true, but as much as or more often out of a kind of subjective desperation, with its principal motive, a bit like Augustine's, being religious, a self-protection against the unbearable consciousness of entropy. More that than out of any newly discovered capacity to reimagine the great web of human relationship as the block which all our lives interactively constitute.
Okay, questions? Yeah.
Thank you. I very much enjoyed the whole way you sort of brought out different portraits of time in different literary traditions. I'm thinking maybe there's another strand that I personally find very effective, where I guess in the people that we looked at, Dante, Shakespeare, even though some are big time and some are small time, time is our transactions, our dealings with time are always somewhat heroic, Dionysian in some sense. Whereas I
Did you say Dionysian?
Yep.
Yeah.
It's the first time I get to use that word in many conferences. Another strand, I think, where the relation is much more, our relation to, or the character's relation to time is much more pensive and Apollonian, where I guess there is some kind of dwelling on the banality of the present. And the kind of, I have in mind James and Carver, people where there's something about all the action is in the future, in the past, but the present is very banal, and there's something kind of dispiriting about it, and maybe that these people capture more the block conception, right? Because the big time people we looked at are definitely flow people, and the small time people we looked at are kind of neither here nor there. But these people that I'm thinking of, maybe they are the pure block people. The people try to capture some kind of an unchanging sort of standing time that where in the present nothing really happens.
Yes, that's really interesting. I guess the feature of that group is that the block is depressing and meaningless and monochrome, and I guess I could probably assimilate that to my notion of post-romantic conceptions of time in poetry reasonably okay, couldn't I? I haven't thought of it quite that way, but I don't think that's actually spoiling the sequence. Look, that's very helpful. This is at a very early stage of thinking, and I think I'll need to nuance that third part of the poetic account a lot, so that's going to be a helpful way to do that.
The resources you've pointed out for making poetry distinctive are actually resources that you would typically associate in the 20th century, say, with the novel. So it's a large historical perspective, or two historical teleological perspectives, which give the kairos to the event in the actual immediate event, say, of Homer or Dante. It seems to me if you wanted to emphasise what's revolutionary about the hyper-organisation of poetry, you need to look at the clause-by-clause resources where the conscious reader can't track what's happening in the way that you can track big movements of plot and individual words like time. So that, for instance, if you look at, linguistic tense rather than philosophic tense, you'll see in English, but not in all languages, you've got about five choices over certain issues of completion, incipience, responsibility for agency. You've got five choices against which to, in some sense, set the parameters for the verb. And you can play those off against the fact that any noun group, you have an enormous array of, well, you can basically splice any noun as an adjective against any other noun. So you can keep subclassifying into an open system, hence it's considered an open system with a dictionary, not part of the grammar. What I'm suggesting is that when I look at a lot of poetry linguistically, you can see that the most distorting or perturbing aspects of time are those where the resources in the verbal group can be enhanced to give heightened processness, and the resources in the nominal group can be made evasive or evanescent, and so that in some sense the thing or reification or the hypostatization in the texture drops. So you can get what I call an existential fabric, where you can set the degrees of actuality or indefiniteness according to the way these typically unconscious systems are played off against one another. So what I'd be adding to your argument is, I'm not denying that all of these points are extremely kairos bestowed, but they're not, in my view, distinctive of poetry, although they may be best exemplified in the poems you've said. And there are other resources which we can stop and catch people at. They're typically grammatical resources that are made unconsciously, which are in fact the engine room of re-temporalizing the texture. But anyway, this is a sort of an alternative way of going about the problem.
It's formidable. I don't know how to respond, except I guess it's quite encouraging that this sort of awfully sketchy outline I've got here sends you off down a track as interesting and rich as that one. It hadn't occurred to me to continue that way, but that's interesting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Simon, for a fascinating talk. I just wanted to offer you as a sort of foil to the small-time poet you mentioned who was so bothered by time as a thing equated with death, a big-time philosopher. Who had a wonderful answer to that, which is very much associated with the Bach view of time, and that's Hume.
Right.
On his deathbed, Hume was asked, I think it was by Boswell, whether, as an atheist, he wasn't afraid that he was about to cease to exist.
Right.
His famous reply was that he was no more bothered by it than by the thought that he hadn't existed before his birth.
Yes.
And this is a thought which crops up later. Some remarks of Einstein very late in his life, which appeared to be a sort of reflection on the rock universe view as it's associated with modern physics, and especially with Einstein's own view.
Yeah, right.
It seems to be the same sort of taking comfort from the rock universe view.
Right, absolutely. Well, that's helpful, actually. That will reinforce that part of the paper a lot. So. And I wonder whether more generally there aren't other things that philosophers have said, as it were, unguardedly, about life or about their lives that one could use as well, and biographical insights into the models that they've thought of in their studies. Go back to Hume again. What we think when we're outside the study is not the same as what we say when we're in it.
Okay.
Yeah. So I was wondering if some of the most interesting issues might not come up with where poets and novelists explicitly mention time and say what they think about it or what their characters think about it. But in the way they kind of use time to structure the novel, or the poem. So in novels, you have kind of the time in which the novel is happening that it's describing, and you also have the time in which it takes you to read the novel, and usually there's interesting interaction between those two times, especially in Proust and other writers.
Or many novelists who do fascinating things with sequence and narrative and flashback and so on.
Right, and then because you were particularly interested in poetry, I thought that was interesting because in poetry you seem to have three dimensions. So there's the time of the action, kind of the time it takes you to read the poem, and then there's also the rhythm of the verse. So that gives poets actually kind of three things to play with rather than the novelist's two, which is where a lot of interest in these.
Yeah, that's interesting too. I guess I was a bit constrained by the demands of the original sketch that I had to do, to try to think of examples from poetry not only over a huge chronological span, but also
ones that you could put alongside kind of explicit things that philosophers said at that time, so explicit things that poets said at that time, rather than looking at how a poem or a novel might actually work with time. You're right, that's something else that one could do very easily.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Just supporting the block view is Einstein's famous comment about explaining relativity. Someone said, what's it like? And he says, well, 5 minutes in a dentist's chair seems like an hour. An hour with a pretty girl seems like 5 minutes.
A poetic moment from Albert.
Is this big time, small time distinction to generalize to other forms of art? I mean, are there big time movies and small time movies?
Well, I guess. What do you think? Yes,
yeah,
that's a way you could generalize it. Yes. Trying to think of some examples. What would a big time, an example of a big time movie be? Westerns.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you think? Where the individual is. My biggest worry about westerns is that the individual is just the John Wayne character is usually just as robotic and driven as Aeneas, who's actually the original behind most of those movies. So that would be an example from the movies of a big time.
Mm-hmm. And small time.
I should think a lot of I think more of European art house type movies actually, where there isn't the same reduction of the individual against a big time perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
a quick question: they weren't actually cousins, but cousins in law. But did Bergson influence perhaps Proust, or did Proust influence Bergson in any way? Was there any influence either way?
I'm not aware of it. I don't know if anybody else can. Do you know about this, Jeanette? But not the other way around, right?
But not the other way around.
Mm, okay. Because I've asked that of many people, so I'm glad to have the answer.
But Proust, I mean, he doesn't actually mention Bergson anywhere in the research, does he? But he does in letters.
I don't know. Actually,
I wondered what you thought about the relationship between cause and your two views of time. Because I think there's a certain idea in aesthetics that if you take the right approach to a work of art, you view it as standing outside a causal nexus. Interestingly, Einstein was interested in Spinoza's philosophy, and there's the famous phrase that's associated with that, viewing something sub specie aeternitatis.
Mm.
Now, you mentioned Kant, and Kant, in attempting to tell us about cause from a Humean point of view, imagines in the Critique trying to work out on the basis of experience, or some sort of experiential manifold or field of experience, the difference between space and time. He says, he imagines trying to work out the difference in terms of, I think it's a ship moving across, or an impression of a ship, or I don't know how I should say it since I don't have a very clear grasp of what he had in mind, but at any rate, he tries to work out the difference between a temporal and a spatial sequence, and on the basis of that, he's going to tell us what a cause is. But it looks as if he's, in order to do that, he's already stepping outside time, isn't he? It might. I don't know whether the sub specie aeternitatis view, the non-causal view,
if is
exactly the same as the Bloch view. Though a Bloch view does seem to have something to do with getting the causal nexus under mental control, because when you, so to speak, put the universe in a block, you're standing outside causes and you say, oh, now I understand how the universe unfolds.
Mm. Look, if I try to talk about causation, I'm going to get myself into water that's much too deep for me very quickly.
But what about in literature? I mean,
But the reason I mentioned the shield of Achilles at the beginning is exactly as an example of the kind of thing you're talking about. A moment when art takes us right outside the world of cause and effect, just briefly, before putting us back into it again. The extension of that is that the entire poem does that for ordinary life that we as readers of the poem have, in just the way that the shield of Achilles takes us out of the Trojan War at the moment that that scene happens in the poem.
There's an example of Auden, of course, who wrote the poem The Shield of Achilles, in which he used the images of World War II as his, and after World War II and the Holocaust as his divisions on the shield, on the escutcheon. And that's, again, the mechanism you've been highlighting of it's a double scene.
Yeah.
That's a shorter poem, but it's still a common
the same
of novels.
The same poem.
Yeah.
Yep, in the red.
Just going back to your comparison of Shakespeare and existentialism, you mentioned that existentialism...
Gosh, did I do that?
existentialism had quite a gloomy outlook on the passing of time, whereas in Shakespeare, they did accept the gloominess of the passing of time, but they're also quite positive on it because it drove them to act or whatever. But I would argue that... it's going back to the Nietzschean thought embracing life.
Eternal recurrent. You mean the Dionysian and Apollonian point, or the eternal recurrence?
Not necessarily eternal recurrence. I was more thinking about the embracing life. And it's depressing that we're all going to die, but that's something that drives you to act and take life by the throat. And I think there's a line in I Heart Huckabees that says, the universe sucks, but that's what gives you la force, which is quite a positive aspect of it.
I hadn't thought of Shakespeare in those terms, but yes, that's the kind of difference I was getting at between existentialist thinking and
Jason?
There's something I can't put my finger on, and I'm hoping you can put my finger on into your finger or somebody's. In French drama...
The moving finger.
In Beckett, and even more in Henri's serious plays like Joan of Arc and Antigone and Thomas More, where you've got characters explicitly arguing with each other about fate, and how does that... I'm sorry this is such a vague question, but how does that play into the post-romantic conception of time?
No, you mentioned Antigone.
Yeah.
You mean Henri's Antigone.
Yeah.
Right. And what were the other examples?
Other examples from Henri's serious plays. Thomas More changing his mind about whether he has to serve the law or the king, and Joan of Arc.
Right.
They're all characters who they're arguing against Greek tragedy, but they're actually arguing as characters with each other.
So, the quick answer is I don't know. Maybe it's the time of day, the long dark tea time of the soul. I don't know how I would separate that from the more general thing that I was saying about existentialist views of the block. So let's talk about it after I think about it.
I was interested in your comment that the small time view goes with the flow view of time, and thinking about the possibility of combining a small-time view of time with a block view. I'm not quite sure about poetry, but again, getting back to the only art form I know, my favourite art form, which is movies. I was thinking about Memento. There's a guy in here that's very much struggling with time in the small-time way, but the movie seems very much to take the block view of time. After all, it shows all these moments, sort of actually flowing backwards.
Right.
And so on. So maybe this is an illustration. This is a
counter
art form where we have the small time view combined with the block view.
Yes, maybe. I mean, I haven't thought about movies or even anything very contemporary. I mean, this stops at middle of the 20th century. So this is obviously something I should do more of.
So how do you get? How is it? I was again, on the relationship between those two distinctions, how is it exactly that you get from small-time view to flow? Is it because you're sort of struggling with this encroaching flow?
Well, what I'm saying, I think this is, yeah. This is what I'm trying to say, the point about Shakespeare and Homer is that they're small-time, but they're only quasi-chiric, to use that Kairos term, rather than fully chiric. I mean, the seasonableness or meaningfulness of the life is only within the individual life. So it's not really either flow or block. It's outside that dichotomy.
Okay. Any other questions that I missed? Okay, thanks, Simon, very much.